Across the Pacifica Network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 16, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. As the US sends suitcases of cash to bribe Iraqi tribal leaders, Iraqi opposition leaders meet in London. The Hindu fundamentalist BJP party win a landslide victory in the Indian state of Gujarat. Many Muslims are fleeing their homes. And we begin a week-long special series looking at the plight of refugees worldwide. Today we examine the US policy of jailing arriving asylum seekers. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush named former New Jersey Governor Tom Keene to run the official investigation into what happened on September 11th, now that Henry Kissinger has resigned. Yet other Nixon aides have been added to the independent commission. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
Kissinger says he didn't want to break his personal business ties in order to sit on the 9/11 commission. The choice of Kissinger had been widely panned, as the former Secretary of State is wanted in five countries for questioning about alleged war crimes, and he's also been known to lie to Congress. Republicans have named former Illinois Governor Jim Thompson to the 10-member panel, as well as attorney Fred Fielding, a close advisor to Presidents Reagan and Nixon.
Fred Fielding, he was definitely, for an extended period, one of Nixon's take care of it guys. He was also one of the names floated as Deep Throat.
Nora King has been chasing U.S. government secrets for 30 years. Her father-in-law was kidnapped during the 1973 coup in Chile. Henry Kissinger is accused of engineering. King says 9/11 victims' families shouldn't count on the government to present the truth of what happened that day. Josh Chaffin in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration's anti-abortion stance is threatening to wreck a United Nations regional conference on population and fighting poverty. Susan Wood has more from the U.N.
More than 40 countries are represented at the 5th Asian and Pacific Population Conference, which opened today in Bangkok, Thailand. The Bush administration has angered officials from India, China, and Pakistan, as well as representatives of grassroots organizations, by its insistence on changing the language of a landmark international family planning agreement. That agreement, reached in Cairo in 1994, calls for improving women's legal rights, economic status, and access to health care. The Bush administration says some phrases in the document can be read as promoting abortion. If the U.S. holds to that position, participants say it could wreck the Bangkok conference, preventing it from dealing with issues including reproductive health, gender equality, and preventing HIV and AIDS. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
A judge in Delhi has convicted four people accused in the attack on the Indian parliament in a special prevention of terrorism court. Vinod K. Jose reports from New Delhi.
A Delhi University lecturer, a pregnant housewife, her businessman husband, and a surrendered activist from Kashmir were convicted for conspiring with the dead gunman who attacked the Parliament House to wage war against the state. Special Judge S.N. Dhingra, while convicting the accused, said he would pronounce the sentence tomorrow. While the government and the right-wing parties welcomed the judgment, many senior lawyers and human rights activists still feel that there are lack of evidence for prosecution to prove the case against the college professor and the accused woman involved. All India Committee of Activists and Scholars defending the college professor Gilani said that they would go for appeal in the high courts and would make use of whatever democratic options available to them, as they are not convinced that Gilani is guilty. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Protests in Venezuela turned violent today. Most of the media coming out of the country reports a debilitating strike that has a chokehold on the flow of oil. But others report that the strike is really an attempt to sabotage the economy by those who oppose democratically elected and populist President Hugo Chavez. There are reports of opposition organizers beating shopkeepers into closing. Others say oil is being intentionally spread on major highways and sawdust put in trucks to slow oil exports. Transit workers in New York City remain on the job, and negotiations continue today, though the union contract expired at midnight last night. Nell Geiser has more from New York.
The union won't say how long negotiations will go on, but for the moment a transit strike is on hold. The dangers of subway work have been foregrounded since two workers died in separate accidents last month. Union members say the procedural issues are important measures of respect, but that transit officials must abandon their offer of a wage freeze in the first year of the three-year contract in order to avoid a strike.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand where we're coming from. We feel we deserve more money for the amount of responsibilities that we have. It's a dangerous job. We move 7 million people a day without any injuries. We feel that we should be paid in proportion to the responsibility that we have.
New York City transit workers earn an average of $44,000 a year, less than workers in other New York public transit agencies. Tonight, union members and their supporters will gather at City Hall to call for a fair contract and ask Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Pataki to weigh in on behalf of the workers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in New York.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The London Observer reported this weekend that dozens of teams of elite American soldiers and intelligence specialists have been sent into Iraq with millions of dollars in cash to bribe Iraqi tribal leaders away from Saddam Hussein. The Observer says tribal leaders command the allegiance of millions of Iraqis and have historically supported Saddam Hussein for pragmatic rather than ideological reasons. Similar tactics were used against the Taliban when teams from the CIA carrying briefcases full of money bought off key power brokers, accelerating the hardline Islamic regime's collapse in the face of the American bombing and the advance of local opposition troops. Also today, Iraqi opposition and exile groups backed by President Bush were meeting in London. Aaron Glantz has this report.
Well, I think it's so far has been extremely successful. I think we've shown this, that the opposition is united, that we do have work from the same paper, that we do believe in a free, united Iraq, and that the Iraqi people have the right to decide what form of government that they want.
That's the voice of Sheikh Ali bin al-Hussein. He'd be the king of Iraq today if revolution hadn't deposed his grandfather more than a half century ago. Now he's trying to reclaim the throne. He's part of a Pentagon-backed coalition to seize power in Iraq after George Bush's war. At the meeting in London, Sheikh al-Hussein met with leaders of two rival Kurdish armies, the right-wing Iraqi National Congress, and hard-line Islamic activists who want to turn Iraq into a fundamentalist state like Afghanistan under the Taliban.
The notion that this has anything to do with democracy in Iraq is a sick joke.
Noted novelist and playwright Tariq Ali speaking at a labor-sponsored forum in Istanbul. Ali notes a previous agreement by the United Iraqi Opposition.
At a State Department conference recently held in secret in the United States with members of the Iraqi opposition, each of them wanting to be the Hamid Karzai of Baghdad, there was a discussion, informal discussion, on what would be the civilian casualties and how many civilian casualties in Iraq were tolerable to affect this regime change. And the figure they came up with was 250,000. 250,000 new Iraqi deaths were all right if the price was freedom. Freedom? Freedom for the oil companies?
Also on the bill at the forum, Professor Noam Chomsky. Chomsky compared the Iraqi opposition meetings to those sponsored by the United States that helped the new government in Afghanistan form, with Hamid Karzai at the head and regional warlords in charge of most of the country.
They called it, correctly, the Iraqi Loya Jirga. But apparently they didn't look back to see what the Loya Jirga was. The Loya Jirga was a farce, which the Afghans dismissed because it was an American-sponsored show which ordered the king to withdraw, who was probably the most popular figure, and put in an American figure, who may be a nice person, Hamid Karzai, but he has so little support that he's surrounded by U.S. special forces. And, you know, his own defense minister would probably kill him if he had a chance.
Indeed, the Iraqis meeting in London over the weekend didn't talk about setting up a democracy, but a federation with different factions in control of different parts of the country. It's a formula that will likely require a large American occupying army, says writer Tariq Ali.
Once you topple Saddam Hussein, which they're planning to do, the one thing that people will expect is democracy, which Saddam Hussein denied them. If you then deny them that democracy and give them something which pretends to be a democracy but in reality isn't, people will be angry and they will respond in different ways. As for How they will react exactly, it's difficult to see. The only armed groups in the country are the Kurdish organizations. The bulk of the country's population are Shiites, 75%, maybe more. So if these people are denied the right to rule the country, I think the United States is going to be in trouble. And I think they will need a large occupying force to run that country unless they do a deal with Saddam's army.
Meanwhile, the Qatari satellite channel Al Jazeera reported today the United States has moved 500 Special Forces troops across the Turkish border and into Kurdish-controlled Iraq, and the Turkish television station NTV aired a similar report stating 50 U.S. military vehicles had crossed from Habur, Turkey, into northern Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News in Istanbul, I'm Aaron Glantz.
And meanwhile, as the rhetoric from the White House continues, today Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said that Iraq would not be given a second chance to correct omissions in its declarations of arms capabilities to the United Nations. This as the dissent within the country against a US war on Iraq increases. This past weekend, an anti-war march began in the predominantly Dominican neighborhood in Upper Manhattan and ended with a rally at the Harlem State Office Building on 125th Street. Some 1,000 people took part in the mile-and-a-half walk through cold, steady rain. From New York City, Dred Scott Keyes brings us to the streets of Harlem.
We gotta stop this war! Can I get a hell yeah, we gotta stop this war! No queremos guerra! No queremos guerra! Queremos paz con justicia! Paz con justicia! Eso queremos!
Hell no, we will go!
From money that could be spent in this country. $4 billion are being spent on a foreign war, when it could be spent on money for schools, money for education. And I think that's an important part of the young movement.
I love the fact that young people are coming out and organizing, and that's a big reason. I was actually supposed to be out of town, and I decided to stay primarily because the young people were organizing this. One of the organizers, I know him since he was in nursery school. And who would have known that he would turn out to be a radical and one of the leaders of this march? So, of course, I'm here to support the youth.
We are here to join with all those who oppose the coming war against Iraq. We're also here to argue that the best way to put a stop to imperialist war is by fighting to build a revolutionary party of the working class.
Why are you out here?
Because this war is totally about oil, not about safety or security. And it's totally about, you know, the U.S. having power throughout the Middle East and throughout the world. And that all the money's going to war instead of housing and healthcare, education.
George Bush, we know you. Your daddy was a killer, too.
Well, I think it just sets a very bad precedent, you know, to go in and bully our way in and try to take something for our need with violence is just not a good example.
What is it about this war that you protest?
Well, there's so many levels. Like, one, it's a war and I'm against all wars, maybe almost all wars, but I haven't seen one yet that I was for. Two, the profiteering, the fact that it's an oil war. Three, like, this war, it's really one massive syndrome where this war is linked up with the entire stolen election, the homeland security. A friend of mine once said it like this. It's like the oil industry is dying and is having its last gasp because technology has moved on. And the only way to keep society from moving onwards is to create wars over oil.
Iraq has not taken any offensive action against the United States. I think that rather than have a preemptive strike against the Iraqi government, that we ought to have a preemptive strike against the unelected Bush administration.
In this time of pending constant war, our veterans are really unstable right now. I think that the sniper attack, the shooting in Arizona, were both Gulf War vets. Domestic violence victims in North Carolina and Fort Bragg base, all of them were veterans of having fought in Afghanistan. There's no outlet for those feelings, and there's no distinction, I think, between, you know, the right to kill over there, and then all of a sudden you come back here. And we need to help, you know, like need to provide more service. And 40% of our homeless people are vets. Obviously, they're not getting the kind of service they need.
In Harlem, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
Yesterday, the Hindu nationalist BJP won a landslide victory in the western Indian state of Gujarat. The election is widely seen as a test of the success of the Hindu revivalist platform, which some label fascist, and is likely to change the shape of politics in India for years to come. As the BJP's landslide victory became clear, Gujarati Muslims, who were targeted in the worst ever sectarian violence since India's independence some 10 months ago, began to leave their homes, fearing another round of violence. Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad about how the BJP's hardcore Hindu ideology swung Gujarat's voters.
We are Hindu!
We are Hindu!
We are Hindu!
Hindu's leader is Narendra Modi!
Outside the BJP headquarters in Ahmedabad yesterday, hundreds of BJP supporters filled the streets, shouting, dancing and setting off firecrackers. Red vermilion powder filled the air as victorious candidates arrived to celebrate their landslide sweep. And when the chief architect of the victory, Narendra Modi, arrived, his supporters went berserk. Modi has been inducted by the National Human Rights Commission, independent inquiry commissions, and a host of Muslims for deliberate complicity in the Hindu-Muslim violence. Last spring, thousands were killed in the worst ever post-Indian independence sectarian violence between Hindus and Muslims, after a train carrying Hindu activists was burnt in the Gujarat town of Godhra. Reprisal attack on Muslims continued across Gujarat for months. But Modi used the Hindus killed in the train attack as the main campaign issue, though he never mentioned the thousands killed thereafter.
On my back, I was witness to brutal killing of our people, innocent women, small kids. I had then pledged on the Godhra railway platform itself to protect the 50 million people of Gujarat. The fire that burns inside me is the same that you have inside.
The BJP had reasons to celebrate in Gujarat, but as their landslide victory became obvious, Muslims retired to their ghettos. Just one street away from the BJP office, inmates of the last remaining Muslim relief camp wept. Khatisa Bibi Munwar, an elderly Muslim woman, watched while her three daughters were brutally killed by the mobs and destroyed her home.
Our children were cut into three and burnt to death. Now the BJP has won. I don't have any idea of our future.
She holds Modi and the BJP responsible for her misery. Professor J.S. Bandukwala, a Muslim professor in Vadodara, admits that the Hindu ideology won over humanity.
It seems the whole purpose of sending Narendra Modi to Gujarat was to polarize society so thoroughly and then go for elections.
Modi's campaign platform repeatedly emphasized that only the BJP would guarantee safety and security of the state from Islamic terrorism. Modi bolstered his campaign by branding the main opposition, the Secular Congress Party, as pro-Muslim. Yusuf Khan works with the Times of India in Ahmedabad.
They have divided the society into the two groups, and that has paid rich dividends. They had employed all the methods to win this election, including demonizing Muslims as if they are terrorists.
But in the glow of victory yesterday, the BJP state president Rajendra Singh Rana denied that his party will differentiate between religions.
We are as responsible as majority people and the minority people equally.
The BJP swept the election, taking 126 seats, leaving only 51 seats to the Congress in a 182-seat assembly. BJP celebratory processions through some Muslim areas sparked minor violence, killing two people. Gujarat's Muslims are still apprehensive, and if another attack does come, they are prepared, unlike last spring. Even 5-year-old Abdul Rahim is all set to face his enemies. He stood outside a polling booth during elections last week, wrapped in Congress flags.
Oh, mother, give me a gun so that I can jump into the battlefield.
From Ahmedabad in India, I am Binu Alex with Miranda Kennedy for Free Speech Radio News.
At the European Union summit in Denmark, 10 countries were invited to join the union. The most common word used to describe the occasion is historic, especially because many of the applicant countries are east of the former Iron Curtain. But many citizens of Europe and the newly invited countries have concerns about the future of democracy and the formation of a superstate Europe. Patrick Beckett has more from Copenhagen.
And when we are talking about a Babylon system, we are talking about the US Empire and hopefully not about the EU Empire.
The European Union grew from 15 to 25 countries this weekend in Copenhagen. At the same time, EU Convention President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing is quietly drafting the new constitution of the European Union. The EU flag has 12 stars and a circle on a blue background. The U.S. flag in 1777 had 13 stars in a circle on a blue background. Is Europe headed for superstate status? The political elite say national sovereignty is not being challenged, yet more and more directives come from Brussels, where the primary EU institutions are based. Critics from the far right and the far left fear the growth of what some are calling the United States of Europe.
There is no real democracy in the EU as it works now.
Niels Meyers is with the June movement in Denmark, which is critical of the EU.
For the European Parliament, EU Parliament, voting percent is about 50 or even below 50%. So it's a little bit like United States with very low voting percentages, and we don't think that's a good thing for democracy.
The tiny island of Malta, with just 380,000 inhabitants, is one of the countries invited to join the EU. Sharon Ellis Bonici is from the No to EU movement in Malta. She says Malta will have only 5 representatives in the European Parliament, but there are 23 committees in the Parliament, so Malta's representatives won't even be able to attend them all.
The EU as itself is, if it had to apply to join the EU, it doesn't fit the democratic criteria that the EU requires when a country applies to join the EU. You know, it's a very undemocratic system, and I don't believe in it.
In other news from the summit, the European defense policy, which includes a 60,000-strong military force, took a step closer to reality. The EU's first mission will start January 1st with the deployment of 500 troops in Bosnia. Turkey took a prominent position in the EU summit, pushing European leaders to speed up the process for their application into the EU. They were helped by the Bush administration. Bush himself called acting EU President Anders Fogh Rasmussen, urging the Europeans to invite Turkey to join. But cultural differences and human rights concerns resulted in Turkey's application being put on the back burner until a progress review in 2004. In the streets of Copenhagen, 10,000 demonstrators took part in 3 days of demonstrations and an NGO forum. Here are just a few of the voices from the streets.
During the last decade, the European elite has constructed fortresses in order to keep out unwanted persons.
If they're really looking for weapons of mass destruction, it's in companies like Union Carbide, in Monsanto, in the killer chemicals and killer GMOs they are generating. They are weapons of mass destruction dispersed throughout our economies. They don't have to hunt for them with a microscope in Iraq.
How dare they call the EU a project of democracy and human rights?
Patrick Beckett, Copenhagen for Free Speech Radio News.
Detention of immigrants in the U.S. did not begin on September 11, 2001. After surviving terror, torture, and in some cases life-threatening circumstances, many immigrants flee to the safety of other countries and come to make up what the world knows as refugees. This week on FSRN, we bring you a special 5-part series highlighting the plight of refugees worldwide. And we begin today right here in the United States, long considered the land of the free and protector from persecution. Yet, as Sharan Louise Harper reports from WBAI in New York, arriving asylum seekers to this country often find themselves in shackles with the promise of indefinite incarceration in INS detention.
When I arrived at the United States, I was handcuffed and taken to a detention center near the airport.
Etienne arrived earlier this year and was lucky to be released after only 3 months in jail.
I, for one, I never thought I was going to be in jail while seeking asylum.
According to a report by the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, Refugees Behind Bars, changes in the treatment of refugees fleeing persecution began during the 1980s with the expansion of imprisonment for asylum seekers. The practice became codified with the passage of the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act that requires the mandatory detention of immigrants who arrive without valid documents. This law places the onus on refugees to satisfy a credible fear of persecution standard before the U.S. will grant asylum. Archie Piatti, Equal Justice Works Fellow in the Asylum Program with the Lawyers Committee, tells us about the law.
Ever since 1996, asylum seekers are subject to a procedure called expedited removal, in which they are subject to a decision made by INS officials at the airport as to whether they will be allowed to stay in the United States or not. Right at the border, they may be deported. If they are allowed to stay in the United States to pursue their claim for asylum, they are subject to mandatory detention. Whether or not they have their documents in order, they can be taken into detention centers around the country and kept for indefinite periods of time.
Pre-September 11th, detainees are imprisoned in county jails, federal facilities, and centers run by private corrections corporations at a cost of up to $100 per day, according to a United States immigration report from Human Rights Watch. Federal regulations require only minimal monitoring of conditions in these institutions. In most facilities, prisoners are denied contact visits with friends and family. Immigrants have difficulty communicating with attorneys and advocates because of language barriers. They may also endure abusive treatment by guards, racial slurs, substandard food, and lack of access to reading materials in their own languages. Etienne tells us of his experience in detention.
Most of us were having problems sleeping because the lights were always on 24 hours and it was so bright that we couldn't sleep at night. We had to shower in the same room where we sleep. The shower was separated from the beds through a wall which was so tall up to our waist level. When you take the shower, somebody can see you from the other side of the room, and it wasn't all that comfortable because there was no privacy in it. For the toilet, where you stool, somebody can also see you as you bend down and stool. And at that time, many of us feel so ashamed of being exposing ourselves to people.
The harshness of prison conditions and separation from community are seen to have extreme psychological consequences. Will Coley, project coordinator of the Immigrant Rights Program at the American Friends Service Committee in Newark, New Jersey, explains.
There have been several attempts at suicide, and those folks have been put in solitary confinement for observation. And they apparently do have access to mental health practitioners, but it's questionable whether or not there's any preventive mental health therapies going on. It's usually for people in the most dire situation, and those are folks who are suicidal.
The 1996 immigration law makes provision for parole of detainees when it has been demonstrated that the asylum seeker poses no threat to society and has ties to the community. The majority, however, remain incarcerated until they are deported or granted asylum. In 2001, it appeared that the proposed Refugee Protection Act would ease restrictions on refugees detained before the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon.
Unfortunately, that law never made it, largely because of the effects of September 11th. There have also been some other legal changes since September 11th, which make it pretty clear that we're not going to see any such improvements in the very near future.
From New York City, I'm Sharon Louise Harper for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.